Well, okay, this is where we're going to start for the recording, at least. I'm always frustrated when we don't move along the needle on the time schedule, and we've been kind of stuck here for a while, and we're probably, with this lesson, should be able to move on next week. There's so many things that happened in this period I put up here from 1919 to 22, that two-year period. You want to back up before World War One too, that's okay, but that post-World War One period is so rich with things that happened, and it sets up so much controversy that the world will deal with 20 years, 30 years, 40 years later. So I think it's been worthwhile, at least for me, and I do these studies for me, to go through this and get it settled, exactly what happened. And when you have that down, then you can make some comments about, you know, later on, because you remember what happened, why it is that way now. So as one more lesson to do before World War II, and I think we'll do that next week, and that will be on the revolts that occurred from, well, the first revolt was in April of 1920. We'll mention about that. But so it started there, and they really haven't stopped. But up until World War II, the revolts kept on going. 39, important date because the white paper was written by England limiting again the immigration into the Holy Land, which very, very frustrating for the Jews. So we'll do that. And some of the massacres that occurred under the watchful eye of the British, and it's, in some ways it's heart-wrenching to see this. So we'll try to do that next week in the package, and we'll get that done, and then we'll be up to World War II or close to it. Well, all right. I sometimes don't know what to call these lessons. I call this one commitments and objections, so we're getting into the revolts a little bit, except we're talking verbal revolts. We talked a little bit about international law. Last week we talked about international peace conference at Paris called Versailles. Do want to get the Versailles and its authority mixed up with the League of Nations and its authority. I'll repeat this for you, but I'll tell you first. The Versailles Conference established international law. Versailles Conference established things that were recognized in international law. The League of Nations doesn't do that. Neither does the United Nations, although they, you know, tried a little bit in 1947, which is beyond our study. So international law is something that occurs when nations agree to abide by a certain rule or a treaty or something like that. Sometimes they're written, a lot of times they're not written. We're going to appeal to international law a little bit on Israel's historic rights to the land. Talk about that later on. So last week we talked about the International Peace Conference at Paris that reordered Europe's national borders. Not every border was moved, but those that were belligerent, they were. And when they were done doing that, or I'd say about halfway through it, they organized the League of Nations. And here where it gets a little fuzzy. The Versailles Conference authorized the League of Nations to do something. So when they authorized them to do something, then what they do becomes international law. But it's not because they're the League of Nations. It's because they've been authorized by a superior power entity, in this case was the Peace Conference. So the value of the League of Nations does not lay with and ability to form international law. That's not what the League of Nations does in our story. But it did ratify existing international law. Now, however, its ratification only carries the weight of the organization itself. I mean, the UN has the weight of the UN. It doesn't have the weight of international law. It has the weight of the UN. And, well, it depends on how you look at the UN as to whether it has any authority or not in terms of what it ratifies. So if you have a nation observes the authority, in a sense, the prestige of the United Nations, then you might obey it or do what it says in its Resolution. Thank you. It's a resolution. It's not a law. So someone can honor the resolution and another one doesn't need to. They don't have, you know, how many of the resolutions have been put out by the United Nations and not been have been ignored. All right. So I just want to keep that separate for you in your mind that United Nations or League of Nations is different than the Versailles Conference or the San Ramos Conference. But there's overlap because when the Versailles Conference gives authority to the League of Nations, then that becomes law. Because some of these things were done after the League of Nations were started that were under the auspices of the Versailles Conference. The international law that surfaced in the post-World War I period owe their authority to the nations that agree to them. It's the nations that agree to them, not the League of Nations that accepted them. The conference at San Remo, April 1920, was authorized. It was after the Paris Peace Conference disbanded, and it was after the League of Nations was formed. The conference at San Remo in April 1920 was authorized by the Versailles member nations. Its acts are understood as international law. Versailles could make international law. The League of Nations can only recognize international law. This happened on July 24, 1922, upon accepting the Versailles member nations' determinations. Now, the League of Nations is not the headwaters, as you can now feel, for restoring the land to the Jews. League of Nations. Maybe I say United Nations, I meant League of Nations. But it legitimizes Jewish rights to international existence in the eyes of other nations, of peer nations. Again, just the weight of the League of Nations is all it has. It has no teeth. The League of Nations was short-lived, 26 years. After World War II, another attempt at international peace was the goal of another international body, the United Nations, October 24, 1945. It will be the United Nations that will illegally approve a plan for partitioning Palestine, but it cannot make law. So even they recognize that, and if no other nations would have done anything with the resolution to partition the land, it would have laid there, and it should be laying there collecting dust. But no, lo and behold, Harry S. Truman... Long story behind this. Harry S. Truman, President of the United States, was the first to recognize what the UN suggested. So when Harry Truman recognized what they did, in a sense, the United States made that the beginning of the international law. And then, I think 3 days later, Russia joins in and others join in. So all of a sudden, we have international law been established. Now, we might say the United Nations did that, and they even voted on it. But remember, they just voted on a resolution. They cannot divide the land. So we don't want to give any credit here to the United Nations for having done it. In fact, what they did, it was a bad thing, divided the land. So it will be Harry S. Truman, the United States President, who will be the first to recognize Israel as a state after Israel's own declaration of such on May 4, effective midnight, May 15, 1948. Now, these developments are rooted in the Old Testament. We mention this every week, in the Abrahamic Covenant. And in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 30, first six verses, we'll have detailed information about the restoration hope of Israel after the multi-nation exile to the world, which we in our lifetime have watched them return. Now they have more in Israel now than they do in any other place. That's new. Now here's an interesting point, and we watch our prophetic clock. We're much more impatient with God than God is with himself. So it took about 100 years to accomplish the exile. When Jesus was crucified, you can either pick 30 or 33. I use 33 because I think his birth date's probably about 1 BC rather than 4, but everything I use is funny, so don't worry about that. So it took about 100 years for the exile to be accomplished, which from... It really wasn't fully accomplished, weren't really kicked out of the land, out of Jerusalem, until 135 after Hadrian did it in 135. So you see, it's almost 100 years. Maybe a little bit more, maybe a little less. Now, the stage one, we call it, the dry bone stage, has now been about 100 years in the making. So there's kind of symmetry here. You say, well, it's been a long time. But remember, it took a long time for them to be exiled. I mean, we said, I said this on Sunday in my class. Jesus crucified at whatever age, whatever year it was, and then it took another 40 years before the temple fell. So sometimes you think they might have thought, well, we got away with this, you know. No, God doesn't forget. So Jerusalem was taken away from them, 66 to 70 AD, and then again in 132 to 135 under Hadrian's rebellion, when Hadrian was emperor. So 100 years, say, for example, I said, well, I won't go through that. You can figure that out yourself. My math at home. There were guesses anyway. So what are the headwaters? If it's not, if it was not the League of Nations, we've used these little metaphors of headwater pools and streams that come out of the headwaters. There's three of them, the Christian, the Jewish, and the political, and I think they match up with the time of the Ezekiel 37 dry bones. It probably started before. The Christian pool that forms the Christian tributary started in England 1536. Now talk about 100 years, that's 400 years almost. Out of that came restorationism, came historicism, and then finally premillennialism. I might add dispensational premillennialism, which is what we are. Then we have the Jewish pool, forms the Jewish tributary, and these all come together to form a stream. Started in Switzerland in 1897 with the first Zionist conference with Theodor Herzl. Jews seek to return to the land, and that was really the beginning of Zionism, and it continues. The political pool forms a Gentile tributary. They observe the plight of Gentiles, observe the plight of the Jews, especially when we get into World War II. We saw that in Russia in 1881. These pogroms. The British seek a homeland for the Jews. They deem it expedient at the time of the breakup of the Ottoman Empire, post-World War I, and start movement in that direction with the letter written by Balfour to Rothschild. It was in 17. Now we want to do some extra things. I thought here'd be a good place to put in some things that are out there, but don't know where to put them exactly. And these are the things that occurred against the Jews. And these are not necessarily related to this time period, but they did show up in this time period. So one is the elder protocols, the other one is the blood libel. But before we do that, we just have a little Martian. I thought this was my simplified version of intelligence. The problem of the land in the Middle East could easily be solved by an intergalactic Martian. One who did not consider anything but unfettered observation, in other words, just look, folks. Compare the land masses that are occupied by the Arabs versus the land occupied by the Jews. Now, you don't have to come from Mars to know that there's an imbalance here. That's one. Number two, look where the unwanted Jews are living. Now, you can't probably, can you see the percentages there? We have Russia, 700,000, United States, 6 million. Israel has 4.6 million, South America, 1.2 million, and so on and so forth. Oceania, 94,000, Africa, 290,000. So if the frankly, let's talk like adults here. If these Jews are so odious, why don't you send them to the land where they're out of the way? And that's what a Martian would do. I mean, without thinking, that's well, where they won't cause trouble. And then we have number three: quit telling lies about the Jews all over the world, saying that they're destroying the economy and want to take over the world. So we need to start with debunking the protocols of the Elders of Zion. And I just went to internet and just there are tons of pictures about the protocols of elders. And if you've never heard about them, I'll give you a little lesson about them tonight. They're hoax. Well, I don't know how you call it a hoax. The hoax to me is something is, well, I guess in a way it is a hoax. It's represented as something true that's not. But the book is not a hoax because the book is real. But the message in it is a hoax, okay? That's how it works. So the elders, the protocols of the elder, we have the Sergei Alexandrovich Linus from Russia. That's him. Bless his heart. I don't know about rest of his soul. I don't know where he's probably 6 feet down. So the Protocols of Elders is a forgery. You use that word for whatever you want. It misrepresents truth. In that sense, it's a forgery. Made in Russia by the secret, for the secret police, which blames the Jews for the country ills. Have you ever heard of that ever before? The Jews are here and are causing trouble. It was first privately printed in 1897. Can you anybody remember what happened in 1897? Huh? Yes, what was the first Zionist conference? There we go. Interesting, that is when it was privately printed, made public in 1905. It is copied from the 19th century novel Hermann Goetsch, or however you'd say his name, and claims that a secret Jewish cabal is plotting to take over the world. That's basically it in the Elders' Protocol. But Sergei, blah, 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 was a Russian religious writer, self-described mystic. He was responsible for publishing for the first time in full the Protocols of the Elders of Zion in Russia in 1905 and published it publicly. It appeared as the final chapter of his book, The Great, Within the Small and Antichrist, an Imminent Political Possibility. It's of an Orthodox believer. I wonder what he meant by that. Orthodox would be Russian, no doubt, Russian Orthodox. About the coming of the Antichrist, an alleged abridged version had been published in 1903 in a newspaper. This fellow circulated several editions of the Protocols in Russia during the first decade of the 20th century. Now that's where we are, first decade of the 20th century. Through the early prints, though the early prints were in Russian, the Protocols were quickly spread to the rest of Europe by Russian expatriates after the 1917 revolution. Some of them claimed that they had provided proof that the Jews were behind the Russian revolution. Remember, Jews were always behind the trouble. By the time Nilus died, Europe had been saturated by millions of copies of the Protocols. Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion is a classic in paranoid racist literature. Paranoid, yeah. Racist literature, taken by the gullible as the confidential minutes of a Jewish conclave convened in the last years of the 19th century, 1897. It has been heralded as by anti-Semites as proof that the Jews are to take over the world. Since its contrivance around the turn of the century by the Russian Tsarist secret police, the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion has taken root in bigoted, frightened minds all around the world, and they still are captivated by it. It's part of the conspiracy. The booklet's 24 sections spell out the alleged secret plans of Jewish leaders seeking to obtain world domination. They represent the most notorious political forgery of modern times. Although thoroughly discredited, the document is still being used to stir up anti-Semitic hatred. The Polish language edition and the Protocols appeared in 1920, our time here. The following year, the Arabs of Palestine and Syria used the Protocols to stir up resentment against Jewish settlers in Palestine, suggesting that the establishment of a Jewish state in Palestine would further advance the international Jewish conspiracy. This propaganda tactic persists in the contemporary Middle East. Arabic editions of the Protocols have been widely circulated by official Saudi sources, among others. You're getting this pretty serious thing here. The Protocols were published in America by Boris Brosol, a former Tsarist prosecutor. Auto magnate Henry Ford was one of those who responded to Brosol's conspiratorial fantasies. The Dearborn Independent newspaper owned by Ford published an American version of the Protocols in 1920. The articles were later republished in a book form with 500,000 copies in circulation in the United States and were translated in several foreign languages. By 1927, Ford had repudiated the international Jew, but hundreds of thousands of people around the world had been encouraged by his initial endorsement to accept the Protocols as genuine. So what's it about? The blueprint for world domination, advent of the Masonic kingdom, a king of the blood of Zion, of the dynastic roots of David, The king of the Jews will be the real pope. The ruler, world ruler, will be the patriarch of an international church. Now, read these guys. I did a little bit. I don't want to get into this stuff. Read these guys that believe this stuff. They, oh, yeah, all these things have happened. Well, you know, there's a lot of conspiracy around. You pick up a newspaper, and you can pretty well match them up if you want. You know, it's not that hard. So, anyway, that's been done and continues to be done. All right, now the blood libel is a little different, but it has the same effect. The blood libel refers to centuries-old false allegation that Jews murder Christians, especially Christian children, to use their blood for ritual purposes, such as an ingredient in the baking of the Passover matzah, the unleavened bread. It is also sometimes called the ritual murder charge, and you probably can't, and it's probably good, you can't see, but you have this little drawing, line drawing of some people draining the blood out of a young boy. Now, the blood libel dates back to the Middle Ages and has persisted despite Jewish denials and official repudiations by the Catholic Church and the secular authorities. Blood libels have frequently led to mob violence and have occasionally led to the declamation of entire Jewish communities by the Anti-Defamation League site. Now, if you remember, I forgot the name of the man. In 1918, we had the trial of Dreyfus. But if you remember, it backed up to about 1850, a little before the 1848, 49, 47, somewhere, that we had another person that was accused, that a number of Jews were accused of blood libel in Damascus. So the Damascus libel, and so that's what they were accused of. So these things have been around, and they have taken these quite seriously. And you think that as many as children as these Jews would need to supply their matzah bread, they'd probably figure out somehow that maybe some would get caught. I mean, the bodies would show up or something, you know. But what? If they, you want to believe it, they just don't go away. So we have these returning to our pools and rivers. The Christian impediments. Now, I see these rivers. Now, there's impediments in these rivers like rocks in a stream. Christian impediments come from covenant theology that replaces Israel with the church. They see Israel's claim to the land as anachronistic. In other words, it's over. They had it. It's passed. And now, therefore, they're obstructionists. The Jews have had the chance, squandered it, and now they have no rights whatsoever to the land. That's an obstructionist. The Jewish impediments have their own, as our Christians do, from within. They're divided into three groups. One group that would be against Zionism would be those that believe they should assimilate. In fact, we find a lot of those people in Hollywood these days that have made a lot of money and are well situated. They want to rock the boat. They want to blend with the culture. They really don't want to be known as Jews. They're happy where they are. So in an instant, they obstruct because they're not part of what they could do. They use their wealth to establish the Zionist expectations. Then we have the Orthodox who are against it because what they see is happening in Israel now is a political restoration of the nation, not a messianic restoration of the nation. And they read their Bibles carefully, and they see that it's the Messiah is going to do this. So if the Messiah is not here, then what right have you got to do it? So they're not for it. In fact, they're obstructionists. Now, you talk to the modern Jew, secular Jew in Israel today, they really, I guess I can use the word hate here, the ascetic Jews, they really don't like them because they obstruct progress in their country. And they live off the fat of the land because they become people that contribute anything to their economy. They sit there and copy their notes and walk around in high hats. So they're not liked by the hoi polloi, most of the people. Then we have the group that we would know probably as secular Jews, literalists, Zionists, seeking to establish the Jewish state. There are many arguments in that group how and by what means this should be done. What economic system should be used. There are a number of Marxists, Leninists, socialists that have always been in this group. Maybe a little less now, but I'm not sure. And so anyway, these things go on even within this one obstructionist movement. So these tributaries of the Jews being enamored with socialism, there's really a question. I'd like to go a little further, but there's another of those tangents, so I just mentioned something or two. There are echoing sounds of Jews and the love for socialism. That's true. This is beyond our study to make a definitive determination about the validity of these suggestions. There are a few observations that would tend to favor this conclusion. For example, Lenin was of Jewish extraction. Now, I think it was his grandparents, and I guess that's all it needs to be a Jewish to get the right, I don't know, who counts this out. Well, there's always been a factor that there's an anti-Semitic impulses to blame the Jews for all the mischief in the world, and that was true in Russia as well. As we look at it from here, the Jews are causing red communism to flourish, and they're, for that reason, anti-Semitic. The rise of social-style communism is connected to some significant Jewish personalities, Karl Marx, Lenin, and Trotsky, and there were others, and some of those, I don't know who they are. A lot of times, they're authors, poets, actors, famous people. This is in the beginning of the Red Communism, the Second Revolution, in October 1917. Later, Soviet spies against America, like Jules Roseberg, Robert Oppenheimer, again, a bunch of people that are Jews that were spying for Russia, were caught. Oppenheimer, he actually came back, worked for the United States, didn't he? He was one of those nuclear guys. And their observable reason is that the Jews adopted the socialism model in the early kibbutzim. You know, the early you don't say kibbutzes. Yeah, kibbutzim. They were socialist. In fact, last time we were there, our first group guide said something about that these kids grew up in these kibbutz, and it didn't work out. And I have never, of all the time he talked to me, he never demonstrated the anger he did when he talked about that. He used words I can't use here. I don't even use them, so I know what they mean. And so they got so messed up in their head for being in that kind of situation. And the parents didn't raise the children. They were communally raised. The parents got 1 hour with them from 6 to 7 at night. You know, that's the kind of stuff they had. They were raised, you know, as groups. They were fed as groups. They went to school as groups. They played as groups. And you got to see your parents on appointment. That didn't work very well. Of course, that's what took it down. And in the midst of this, we have kids that grew up. He said, they're just messed up. And you put the word in there he used that I won't use. And he was really angry about that. They really are messed up. All right, all that to say is there was some thinking that the Jews must be socialists because they did the kibbutzes, and they were socialists, but they're not communism socialists like Red. So the Jews were at the start of the Russian communism, but after Stalin disappeared, it seemed like the Jews somewhat disappeared because Stalin wasn't all that in love with them either, although he did outlaw anti-Semitism. Now, the political impediments, we'll talk about this more to come, these are more difficult to trace since they change with the office holder. I mean, we have Balfour, and he's very pro-Israel, and then the next guy comes along, Kuzin, and, you know, whatever. So these guys come and go, and so you can't say there's a unified view of Zionism. It just changes. So during Harry Truman's deliberation, most if not all of his State Department heads were against Zionism and worked against Truman. And Loy Henderson was a foreign aid secretary, very much against Zionism. So we have these things, and now he's supposed to sort all this out, and that's going to be our fun when we get into that period of time. But the political aspect is difficult. So if we would continue our tributary motif, we could say that the Zionist stream received many rocks that seemed to dam the flow. But by the force of divine gravity, the stream always finds its way around the impediment and continues on its way. So Zionism has had many political obstacles that the expectations are low that Zionism would ever be fulfilled. But it is. Okay. Now, a couple of Bible verses just to give you the Bible sense here. Ezekiel 39, one of my chapters I read these days because of what's going on in the Middle East. God says about Israel, which is my glory. The Friends of Israel have their magazine called Israel My Glory. I'm sure it comes from this. He said, my glory amongst the nations, and all nations will see my judgment, which I have executed, and my hand, which I have laid on them. Now, glory is Israel. You know, isn't sheening, you know, shiny thing somewhere. It's his, it's Israel. So Israel is his glory. It's also the apple of his eye, Zechariah 2:8. So watch Israel. And when God does something to Israel, obviously it's going to be to his glory. So when I see all these rocks that are in the stream that's causing impediment, we'd say, wow, that stream is still going and it's still on track. And when I see that, that's God's glory. Because when God does something and it's inexplicable and has no explanation for it, God gets the glory. Now, Moses, this is our passage out of Deuteronomy 30. And just jump down to verse 20. And by loving the Lord your God, Moses says to this generation of people are going into the promised land. By obeying his voice and by holding him fast to him and holding fast to him, for this is your life and the length of your days, that you may live in the land which the Lord swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give them. So this is just a warning or a reminder that if they're going to give, they're going to live in the land, they're going to have to obey him. But this is the land God gave them to live in. And we're just riding on that rail. And a couple of things we'll pick up on this way, on the way out or on the way through here. The World War I Syrian campaign that Allenby ran was really an out-of-the-way war. What we have here on the right is a picture of Jordan in Jordan. In fact, I'd look to me, that would be the Valley Megiddo, the pass that you go through the mountains, but I found that it wasn't, so I was disappointed. The one on the left, I think, is a picture of the pass. Megiddo on the left, I think, and then you look out into the plain of Megiddo, the land of Armageddon. And here we have a modern picture of it. Now, this war, for us, looms large in World War I, but it was a minor war as far as the world was concerned. They weren't really paying much attention. The campaign was generally not well known or understood during the war. The English people thought of it as a minor operation, a waste of precious resources, which would be better spent on the Western Front, while the peoples of India were more interested in the Mesopotamian campaign and the occupation of Baghdad. So I just put this up here so we don't get the idea that what was going on in the Middle East occupied everybody's attention. It didn't. It's just a minor skirmish. It looked like, from what I can tell, it must have taken 2 years for Allenby to start from Cairo and go up to Jaffa, Jerusalem, Megiddo, and on up to Damascus. I told it to you in just a few minutes. But from what it looks like, it took 2 years from the end of 16 to beginning or the end of 18. So anyway, missed point that out so that I don't forget telling you that. Now, the extraction of the Turkish hegemony, the territory that they control from the land, came at the very end of World War I. Remember Damascus? He got there in Damascus on October 30, 1918, and he waited for Faisal to show up and get credit. Remember that? Allenby was in Cairo at the end of 1916, but did not advance his campaign until April, June of 17. That's just not that many miles. Reached Damascus just before the armistice on October 30, 1918. Armistice was 11-11-18. Internationally, the armistice ceasefire, the next task, as you know, is to decide what to do with these territories. And they had already been making plans during the war because these liberated territories are going to be now controlled by these allied powers. In an armistice, there's no surrender, so in the Conference of Versailles, they made peace treaties with every one of these belligerent nations. You didn't have a peace treaty. There was no surrender, no unconditional surrender. So everything was negotiated out. It started with Germany. They went to Austria. They went through these various nations and tried to set up something that would be acceptable. And the Allied side were pretty heavy-handed. They could pretty well write the recipe as how these peace treaties were going to go, especially with Germany. And it did leave some hard feelings with Germany. So now we're up to the darkened shade down to light part. The League of Nations assumed international normalization. The Versailles Conference gives that over to them. In this period now, we have the San Ramos Conference. It's actually started in London in February and was finished in April of 1920. And we have the border set that we will recognize for time and eternity, I suppose, at least for a while. And we know who's going to occupy them by the end of April. 19 or end of April 1920. Now, there's a couple of more treaties that have to do with Turkey because Turkey, well, there's one important, the one on August 10, this is after San Remo, so August 10, 1920, Turkey actually relinquishes the control of the Levant and all Turkish territories, you know, the Ottoman Empire. They actually wrote on the treaty, said, we relinquish these rights. And that's important because if they relinquish their rights, they have no dog in the fight anymore. They have backed out of it. And so now the Allied powers have the total freedom to work on this open range to divide it up. So Turkey wasn't stolen from them, although they were under duress to give it up. And at this Severus conference, they relinquished the right to the land. And I told you, then they came back and divided Turkey like a Holstein cow, and that didn't work for well because there were so many people, hard feelings with people groups in Turkey, with the Armenians were Christians and the Turks were Muslims, that they went to civil war. And so after this was all over, they came back and renegotiated that Severus Treaty and made it the Lausanne Treaty, and that was finished in 1923, even after R22. So I just mentioned that because Turkey did give up the right to this land. They signed the paper giving up the right to the land. That's the same thing. Now, the international law, checking my time. At the San Remo's conference, these borders became recognized international law. The victorious nation's representative have the power to set the borders. This becomes binding international law. It sounds like an echo, but you got that, right? Because it's important. Because it is the argument. It is the argument you never want to let go of. But it won't last long. But you still got to have the argument. So we say the story has been told, the votes are in and counted, the international community, the divided Europe, the Ottoman Empire have spoken in one clear voice. It's done. The territory of the British Mandate is the territory of the homeland for the Jews, last date of July 24, 1922. If everybody would have gone home now, we'd be all happy. But at least we have a start. We have a line in the sand, proverbial, how it's supposed to be. However, as soon as everything is settled, it's not settled. Remember the British-supported Faisal bin Hussein. Bin is the son of Hussein, the guy that's the sharif of Mecca. He is probably the only one that can compete with this guy would be the Saudis from Arabia in terms of big name men. So the father has sons. This is his son, Faisal. He's the house of Hashem, Hashemites, was proclaimed king of the greater Syria, which is Damascus, on March 8, 1920, after the war, remembering Britain's promises to make an Arab nation. French countermanded. Faisal was expelled from Syrian throne just a few months later, July 25, 1920. Only 4 months in office. July 24, 1922, 2 years later, officially the mandate begins. So all this stuff happens before the mandate even gets going. But remember, the international law is in place. It doesn't change. But you have all these other things going on. So far, they're messing with stuff, all right? Because we haven't really talked about the Jews yet. We're talking about promises that the British made to the Arabs. September 20, 1922, the British and the League of Nations remove the east of Jordan River as the homeland for the Jews. Forbid them, in fact, to live in it. You know, international law is violated right there. You just cannot do that. British can't do it. And you can't have the League of Nations not help you do it and make it official. They did it. Now, I think we'd have to finally say that Israel accepted it, and to that extent it becomes international law, but it was taken from them. So England, the mandate trustee, changed the interior borders of the Jewish homeland. The British disallowed Jews in the Transjordan region, that's in the east of the Jordan River region. Any changes made to the San Remo agreement is a violation of international law. The Transjordan area was given to the Hashemite family of Hussein to make good British promises, and I say the second time. I'll go over this. He gave it to it once. Hussein first got Damascus, which was a kingdom. Now he gets another one. So British is coming through with two offers of land. There should be no complaints. You get it? Now, the embodiment of the British Declaration provides a homeland for the Jews. The illegal redrawing of the international border reduced the size of the Jewish homeland approximately 75%. The British mandate was only a custodialship until nationhood could be established. He had no right to do it. Now, next week we're going to start talking about the revolts, because behind the scene now, you don't hear the guns and the explosions and the killing is going on, violence. That's in the ears of the British negotiators. So these mandate provisions were accepted by the League of Nations. Illegal, but they accept them. Doesn't change the law. Doesn't change the law. They accept them. What did change the law? If Israel accepted them. Now, there's one thing that's not that one thing that is missing. If Israel accepted, and I don't ever see anywhere where they actually did accept it, but if the Arabs didn't accept it, then it's still no good. So you have both sides of a nation that's going to divide up a piece of land have to both agree. And Israel, I know many times in 1947 and later on, they've agreed to get the sliver of land that was given to them by United Nations, for example. They accepted, the Arabs refused it. And then when the Arabs refuse it, the offer is null and void. And they went to war, and we know the laws of war. Israel took over the land, and they ought to keep it. That's what happens when you are attacked. Okay, so the League of Nations, that's in September 1922, makes no difference to the international law. So don't fall for that argument. So it must be the... said this, must be the pushback from the Arabs that this was why this was changed. So we say the next section is so difficult to understand. I went over this a bunch of times. I hope it makes some sense. The next section is difficult to understand. September 1922, the Arabs had many advantages and the Jews had very few. Yet the Arabs present their grievances, their demands, as if utterly unique victims. And I said, what ordinarily happens to people of a conquered nation? They buck up and live under it. We talked about the 30 Years' War when you could go to bed at a cat, wake up in a Protestant territory, and just buck up. Or any nation. World War I, World War II, wherever you were, you just had to live in it. But not if you're an Arab. Not if you're an Arab. All kinds of different rules. It's sad to say that they act as helpless juveniles who must be asked for assistance for every task. And that's the impression you get. Can't you guys do anything for yourself? And if it doesn't happen for you, it's somebody's fault because they didn't do it for you? Further, the Arabs are assisted by the waxing and the waning of Jewish support for their cause. Sometimes they're for Jews, and next time they're for the Arabs. And you got this back and forth, and usually it ends up being more for the Arabs than for the Jews. In some cases, there is an outright collapse of British mandated responsibilities toward the Jews and turn as an adversary to the Jews whom they are to protect. Now, for example, the Arabs make their first protest against the British mandate April 1920, San Remo's conference. While it's going on, there's riots in Jaffa. Six Jews were killed, 200 injured. I don't know how many of the Arabs were killed. Now we have this Mufti who will end up being the Mufti. He's one of those kind of really unthinkable things. Here we have this Haj Amin. He is a rebel rouser. I don't have this in my story. I'll probably tell it to next week. He's a rebel rouser, and he leads these insurrections, these riots, and encouraged by the British to do it. And finally, somebody gets the head together and they arrest both sides, put them both in jail. The Jews in jail, they weren't the belligerents, but the Arabs put them both in jail. And they're in jail for a few months. Then somebody comes along and releases them, all of them. And this Haj Amin ends up being the Mufti of Jerusalem. He gets to be the leader of the other side. I said, why would you do that? Why would you do a known troublemaker, put him in the head of troublemakers? The British, I don't understand. It is supernatural to think this way. All right, here we go. The Hajj, I mean, for a few days before Easter, 1920, that's our time there at the San Ramos, Colonel Water Taylor told him that he had a great opportunity of at Easter to show the world that Zionism was unpopular, not only with the Palestinian administration, but with Whitehall, that's London, and disturbances of sufficient violence occurred in Jerusalem. Remember, this is a British guy telling this guy this. If sufficient violence occurred in Jerusalem on Easter, both General Bowles and General Allenby would advocate the abandonment of the Jewish home. He says, explain to him, that freedom could come only through, could only be attained through violence. I said, does anybody have any sense of, no, they don't. In 1921, Haj Amin al-Husseini began to organize larger scale fedaheen, that's a suicide bombing or suicide terror, to terrorize the Jews. Meitzenhagen, former head of the British military intelligence in Cairo and later chief political officer of Palestine and Syria, wrote in his diary that British officials inclined toward the exclusion of Zionism in Palestine. So these are the guys that are supposed to administer it. They're on the wrong side. There is a land as a home for the Jews. Kind of recapping, west of the Jordan River. This is 75% less than the original intended by the Wallflower Declaration. By 100% is accepted by Versailles, then accepted by Versailles and San Ramos. Israel, by not protesting, I'm assuming, accepts the reduced border lines. Britain has made good, at least in good faith, the promises of Arab hegemony out of Damascus, capital over the region, assisted by Faisal to the throne. They did their part. So, did the British make good their promise to Hussein, the father? His son reigned? Yeah, I guess so. So he could hold the throne? That he could not hold the throne can hardly be charged to the British unless they expect the British to go to war with France over this. You know, so they put him in place. Are you supposed to not hold him in place? See, that's what you get. Well, the French came along and, I told him he walked them out with a bayonet point or something like that. Well, the only way you're going to stop something like that is war. Well, Britain's not going to go to war with France over this. They did have the Sykes-Picot Agreement that sort of ceded this to France, sort of. But they still didn't want France to have it. But they weren't going to go into war over it. But now Faisal says, I lost my kingdom. Where's my kingdom? So we go scoring. After 75% of the land of the Jewish homeland was taken, the British attempting to appease the Arabs granted the Hussein family 75% of the land east of the Jordan for a kingdom for the Hashemite king Abdullah bin Hussein. Score advantage. Arab. The Jewish side lost a point due to the British reduction of their land by 75%. The Jews lost another point when they denied access to Jordan because British assigned it to the Arabs. They couldn't. You said, Arab Jews, you can't go into the Jordan. They can't. The Arabs gained Damascus. The Arabs gained Jewish homeland. The British did it voluntarily. Score another point. Then you fight for it. Just give it to them. All right. One other section here. Did the British promise the land to two people? You hear this. Where did this come from? Well, international law says, go back to our earlier statement, does not matter what the British promised. They had no authority to unilaterally grant any land. Whatever came out of the Ottomans' territories was to be divided by the recognized international community. That finished their work at San Ramos, April 1920. They finished the work, set borders, granted the zone for a homeland for the Jews. Period. Done. Finished. Is that it? The British have no authority beyond this. They don't own the land. So, did the British promise the land to two people? You know, they had this discussion and they actually put Faisal on the throne. Well, maybe, but it wasn't authorized. And maybe no. Well, they gave him one land, that was actually ended up giving him two. Yeah, did they deliver? Yes, they did. And yes, again, they delivered twice. The British brought two lands, two opportunities for the Arabs to have their own kingdom, twice. He took it away from Israel and gave them nothing except the little strip that everybody says is not worth anything. What did the Arabs expect from the British? Well, apparently something. It seemed like Faisal was content to share the same in the same way the land of the Ottoman Empire, either divided or shared in common. Look at what he says. Wiseman and he, Faisal, spoke about this, that Faisal, that Zionists could use their this mutual admiration society, you know, they helped him get an Arab land and they'd help with the Jews. That was the discussion. And it was curious that it was curious that there should be any friction, he said, between the Jews and the Arabs, Faisal tells Wiseman. After all, there was plenty of land to go around. We're, you know, leave the guy alone. Don't politicize him. He could see that. There's plenty of land to go around for these people. On January 3, 1919, the two signed their agreement in full expression of goodwill and hope for the future. Jewish immigration to Palestine would be encouraged, while the Zionists would lend their assistance to develop the independent Arab state, which they did twice, which presumably, well, they haven't done it here yet, but was about to be set up by the peace conference. Faisal scrawled a brief proviso to the effect that his consent depended on the British carrying out these promises to the Arabs. Well, they could as best as they could, but Britain really couldn't guarantee anything here because it wasn't theirs to give. But I still ask, did the British carry out the promises of the Arab nation? Yes, they did. So what's behind all this is two letters. We have one letter, is the Ballflower to Rothschild letter, November 2, 1917. The other letter is a McMahon to Hussein, and there were 10 letters here, and they were dated earlier, 1915 to 1916. So about how many months would that be? Is that 16 months? 6 months, something like that. So one says, one letter said about the Jews, the His Majesty's government favors the establishment of homeland for the Jews, an area known as just Jordan today. It was incorporated international law documents. Remember, said and done, sailed, delivered. Now, 2 years before this, there was this discussion going on. You know, I don't say secret, but it wasn't public. So this letter comes up, and it says this commitment is made by Britain to recognize Arab independence after World War I in the limits and boundaries proposed by Hussein, Sheriff of Mecca. That's the father. This is not included in any international law documents. It never was approved by the powers that be. But this is what's being held up. See, we have two letters, and they both promise the same thing. Well, one has authority, and the other one has no authority. Okay, so but what did they claim? What did they want? The McMahon, for the sake of argument, we're going to, you know, there's no point in arguing this, but it's for the sake of argument. From there, from a three-way triangle, you have the French, the British, and the Arabs. The quest for Arab nationhood was answered when the British put Faisal on the Damascus throne. Once. He did not last long as French, according to the Sykes-Picot Agreement, felt it had the entitlement. Britain could not stop France, so Syria fell under the French mandate in the early 1920s. Note it was hard or impossible for British Allenby to give Faisal that which had been promised by Sykes, yet he tried to make good the British promises by giving him Damascus. I repeated myself. I want you to see that map. That's what we're going to talk about. Now, could it not be argued that the British held to their bargain, the Syrian land and for an Arab nation, with Hussein, Sheriff of Mecca, whose son Faisal did ascend to the Syrian throne? Were there other agreements that would prop up a weak government against the French after World War I? Not likely. So here's your job. If you can make it, go. Was Allenby to fight all the wars so that Hussein could have the international caliphate from Damascus to the Arabia? Hardly. It seems that Hussein and those who argued that the caliphate were expecting a glorious empire instead received a short-lived reign in Damascus and then blamed somebody else for their failure. That's what happened, I think. So in the Ballflower, intent was written into international law. The location of the Jewish land was, by common knowledge, where it has always been, and the Bible describes it for centuries. Therefore, a meets and bounds description is not necessary to claim it. Common literature spells out the boundaries from Dan to Beersheba, and obviously from the Mediterranean Sea to east of the Jordan River, settled by 2.5 tribes of the tribes of Israel. When McMahon writes to Hussein, He clearly is excluding, number one, we're going to read this letter in a minute, number one, the Holy Land, and the other in the offer to the Arab Caliphate, which is number two, the area promised to the French. Okay, didn't know how to do this. We actually have two lands here. Can I, you see my arrow? Can you see that? Oh, I can do another way here. This is French land. Okay, so this letter says this is not part of what he's offering to the Sharif of Mecca. And he's describing this by this the series of cities that live along this line. They're colored. You can almost see them here. So he's saying from here to here, west of that line is not included for the Arabs. Okay? So the districts of Mersina and Alexandria, which is up here on the top, portions of Assyria lying to the west of this district of Damascus, which is this line here, the Homs, and we hear quite about that in the news, Hama and Aleppo, cannot be said to be purely Arab and must on that account be accepted from the proposed limits and boundaries. So he's accepting this part, keeping this. Now the question is, what happens below this line? Well, we almost have to go by what's common international. Whose land is it by whatever? So the argument is, well, he just said these cities because that established this line, and anything west of this line would be off limits for the Arabs. And so this is French, and this is for the Jews. Okay? Now, remember, this is 1916, so this is way before the war was over. So they're doing this kind of dividing up the goose before it's dead. When the above modifications and without prejudice or to existing treaties concluded that Arab chiefs, we accept these limits and boundaries, and in regard to the territories they are in which Great Britain is free to act without detriment to the interests of her ally France. So it seems to be ceding all of this land. At least that's what I want to believe. But they want to argue that they didn't cede that. Because they would say that all of this is Syria's land or Arab land, and this goes over to the only thing that's excluded is this section up here, which is what Lebanon and part of Syria. So in this letter, he says, I'm empowered in the name of the government of Great Britain to give the following assurance and make the following reply to your letter, subject to the above modifications. Great Britain is prepared to recognize and support independent Arabs within the territories in the limited and boundaries proposed by the Sharif of Mecca. So this is the question, this line right here. So if you're on one side of the issue, you say, well, this line here, which is Israel, is included in this. If you're not thinking that, we say it is excluded by the fact that this line just established these cities just established this line goes clear down. So that's where the argument comes about whether Britain gave the land to two people. And I say, it doesn't matter. Britain doesn't have the authority to give it. But we argue about it anyway. So I go through it anyway. So here we have the French, and we have the not assigned, which will end up being Israel. And we have Arab and Arab, French and Arab claimed. So they claim all of this. So those letters are written almost 3 years before the armistice. And I ask, what value do they have in light of the League of Nations? Or I should say San Ramos Conference is really what I should have said there. Okay, where are we here? 8:00. A few more slides. Whatever wishful commitment were made in the war may not be kept after the war, which is the case here. This letter between the Britain and McMahon worth nothing, absolutely nothing. The British cannot obligate the French to give up the Sykes-Picot territories after the law. They can't do it. Maybe between them they could argue about some land they have, but they can't make their national community do it. That commitment to the French can remain, and Britain honored that. But Britain is providing the best it can for the Arabs, but there is no way that the armistice would include a commitment to the Ottoman territory to establish an Arab nation. Syria was Britain's idea of an Arab region. Faisal ruled over it for a time. Could it have been larger? Of course. But it would have taken another war, and there were no international and there would have been international ramifications. The British mandate is valid since it received ratification by the international community a number of times. Now, we did this last week. Just go over this one more time. Wilson's 14 points, I think it was argument number 6, provided the consultation with indigenous people to give them a say in their governance. And the Arabs said they never got a say. Well, the Jews really didn't go and say either. while highly attractive, this consulting the indigenous people is impossible. How would you do it? So there are different people, different, you know, you could take a vote, get them all together, they wouldn't agree. The negotiations were difficult enough. They relied heavily on the representatives who made the effort to come to Versailles to present their cases. That's how it was done. Some even came from Korea, walked the distance from Korea, arrived too late to make their cases. Can you imagine how sorry we should feel for those people? The conference leadership did its best. As any war outcome, there are winners and there are losers. There are good losers, and there are were treated horribly. Case in point, the Armenians at the hands of the Turks after World War I were slaughtered in eastern Turkey by the millions, which they still will not acknowledge. But there are bad losers who cannot adjust, and that's what we have here with our Palestinian friends, who are the few Arabs in the footprint of the Holy Land. So how do we summarize this? There is no reason why the Jews cannot have the lands described by, one, historic right, international law, which is the big one, builds on historic rights, and just the humanitarian compulsion that people need to have a land to live. If you're going to run them out of town, let them go somewhere. The few people, even Hussein or Faisal said, there aren't very many people live here. So the necessity of space, because there was no other Jewish land. Every Arab could go somewhere else, but the Jew had no place to go. There are invalid promises made by Britain that are impossible to carry out. The Arabs should have known that. Yet Faisal Abdullah had kingdoms as hoped for and experienced by the British. Even they went beyond the call of duty, I think. The Arabs and Israelis can live peaceably side by side, and they do, unless the Arab threatens the life of the Jew. I know when we were in Asia Minor, the Anatolia, we were there, where were we? Cappadocia. And the people had, they lived in caves. You know, this sand's kind of like, it's like ash, volcano ash. It's really soft. You can just take a spoon and just dig it so you can dig yourself homes. And they have churches in there. And they told us that they, in this valley, gorge, homes both sides, Christians and Muslims live totally in peace side by side. So it can be done. It can be done. It doesn't happen when somebody comes in and stirs them up, like our Amini over here is going to do in our lessons next week. So the expectations of the Arabs have changed. I think it's my last one. Or nearly. When Faisal and Wiseman, Chaim Wiseman, the head of the Jewish Zionist movement, had their agreeable conversation in 1920, Faisal said, welcome, there is enough room for us. But then the issue had not been politicized. Now the only solution is not less land for the Jews, but no land for the Jews. Remember, whatever the Jews give up, the land they give up will not be satisfactory until it's all given up. So there's no point in giving up part of it. Now the only solution is not less land for the Jews, but there were no land for the Jews. The reduction of the 1967 armistice line, and by the way, I don't call those borders, has no merit and cannot satisfy the no Jew in the land expectation. This shows how unreasonable the dispute has become and how unlikely it will be settled without divine intervention. So remember, Waters Taylor explained to the Arabs there that the only way they're going to get freedom is they're going to have to commit to violence. And so that note, we thank the British. You know, is it any wonder that the Jews bombed the King David Hotel in Jerusalem because the British were betraying them right and left? And that's why they did it. Because all of a sudden the Jews become their enemies. Terrible place to be. And this was not monolithic with Israel, with the British. It just comes and goes. You read Churchill one place, he's really pro-Semitic, and next time you read him, anti-Semitic. So you read the same thing in America. You know, but see, the reason that's the political part so difficult, because each individual acts according to his conscience, and if a different person gets in office, then he acts according to his conscience, and it may be totally opposite. So that's why you have this come and go. That's why you only have God to be able to thank and trust to deliver a nation, because it won't be done by human political power, because it will certainly fail. Let's pray, and I'll let you go. Lord, thank you for the evening time together, for the remembrance of this time of our history that was very, very difficult for many, many people, particularly for the Jews, as they are trying to establish a foothold in the land that you've given them, and realize all this is part of bringing them back to the land. We understand they're still under judgment. They still have not come to receive the Messiah as their Savior or their King. But Lord, we realize that will happen. It's due time. In the meantime, we have the message of the gospel even to them, and for those Jews that would receive Christ as Savior, they'd be part of the church, as we've been studying in 1 Peter. So thank you, Lord, for the resources that we have to make these studies, and for the information people have gathered together so we can learn from the past and realize always that that you are looking after your people, and we are observers, spectators in a way, watching what all is happening. Thank you, Lord, for our nation and for its support of Israel even these days. It's, again, mixed. But, Lord, just pray for the leaders. They might understand the necessity of it and the utter disaster of becoming an enemy of Israel, the state of Israel, because then we become an enemy of yours. Thank you, Lord, for our time together. Bless now as we go to our home. Keep us safe and bring us back again next week. In Jesus' name I pray it. Amen.